So, welcome to today's programming languages. Last time we've talked about trying to come up with a useful application for the feature of hardware transactional memory in common software. So what we came up with was, let's say, typical way of accessing hardware transactional memory from our program. And we had this quite general structure with trying to initiate a transaction with that x begin thing and committing with x end and the means for aborting with x abort. And when we had a look at that, we realized that in case that we want interaction with non-transactional implementations somewhere, or even try to implement the fallback path in case that our hardware is not able to support this many instructions, or whether there is a conflict somehow and the transactions keep shooting each other from transacting. So there's need for support for non-transactional parts in there, and these are the ones that we see here. For that, we resort to using standard mutexes in order to ensure that they are working in an atomic way. Now, the thing is that we still need to somehow relate the non-atomic parts, or the non-transactional parts, better to say, with the transactions. And I said that this would work by accessing the mutex counter by just reading from that. However, we were wondering what actually happens now, because with that we only assume that at a very precise spot in the execution of the transaction, which is just that particular read, we actually know that the mutex is not taken so far. So I promised you that we would talk today about the implementation of transactional memory, how it is done in our mainstream Intel implementation. And turns out that it has a few specifics. So in the, I think last time we were talking about these different ways of having granularity of transactions, and there would be one branch which would go in these object structures, which would have a tree-like representation, would try to achieve the atomic changes with just one write to memory, and the other one would be somehow cache-related. And that's the point now where this is important, because the way that Intel has chosen to implement the restricted transactional memory is that they do augment their chips with a few things. For once, they augment the cache lines of the CPUs with the possibility to store an extra bit, like the ones that you've seen with this MESI protocol. And that's another bit that they get, which is T. And what they also do is they extend the system with a register bank and some counter. Yeah, what is the purpose of all that? Well, the idea is that you have to support those new additional constructs, like this x begin. The x begin would then mark the start of the transaction. What do we have to do there? What we have to do is we have to increment the counter, which counts how often I have tried to start the specific particular transaction. And also what we have to do is we have to save the current status of the CPU somewhere where we can find it when we have to abort our transaction. So that's why we have a whole register bank here, just to dump the complete context of the process in terms of CPU state in there. So we keep the register bank there and the transaction counter. This transaction counter is just for making sure that if we have kind of nested transactions, then we actually are able to differentiate between the different exit points from commit points from the transactions, and only at the very end, at the very last commit, we would then discard the register bank and commit everything to memory. So that's what the counter is for. So anyway, when we start our transaction, what we do is that every cache line that is read from or written to actually get the new flag T for transaction. So the next thing is now when is actually when is this transaction aborted? Well, of course there's the explicit way of aborting with the X-abort instruction. However, there's also external reasons for aborting, especially what's classical for that would be a conflict happening. And how does the system realize that there's a conflict happening? Well, there's that's what the transaction bit in the cache lines is actually for. So if that bit is set, a few of the messages that arrive at the respective cache lines are interpreted a little bit differently than before. So if this bit is set and we catch an invalidate message for that particular cache line that is marked as being part of the transaction, then we know that someone else has tried to do a write access on that specific cache line, which is part of our transaction. So that's actually a conflict happening here. So in these cases, someone else has at first decided to write his or her content to memory, so we get an invalidate here. And so we have computed so far with outdated information, so we need to discard and restart new. So catching an invalidate from somewhere else for any cache line that we have is deadly for our transaction. We have to abort. Also, there's other reasons for aborting. For example, if we have a modified cache line that is marked with our transaction bit, and we observe a read message from somewhere else, well, in these cases, we can't really say anymore what the old value was. So in these cases also, we get a problem in the end. So what we do there is we also abort and let the main memory answer the or give the read response to the read, and yeah, abort once again. So there's two situations. One, we have a modified line which is, which someone else wants to read. Then we restart. If there's an invalidate message from somewhere else to any cache line that we own that has a has the marker, then we also abort. Yeah. So why do we treat them differently? Well, as long as we have not modified anything in our cache and still there's a read request coming in, then still we can give the answer about the value of that variable, and we don't need to actually abort. So that would be a way of allowing to share the value as long as as long as the value has not yet been somehow modified. So yeah, that's why we do this fiddling around with the modified state of the cache line. Okay, so in the end, at some point we will either do an abort or commit. And well, what the abort does is it just clears all the lines with the T flags and sets the counter back to zero while restoring the old CPU registers that we dumped into the register bank. And if we have a commit, then we actually need to write everything down. So what we do there is we also decrement the counter because we have kind of left the last, in case that we have left a nested transaction, we only decrement in case that we have left the outermost transaction, we will end up with zero being the most recent value of the counter. And in these cases, we will just clear all the T flags. It's kind of like writing back to memory. Okay, so that's how the restricted transactional memory is actually implemented. So now we can reinterpret what we have seen here. That was the implementation of how we can actually make use of restricted transactional memory in our C program. And now we see that we have included the locks counter in the read set of our transaction. Now, when we perform a wait on a mutex, we will, because it's still zero, we will at some point set it to one. So we will write to the memory location, which will then trigger an invalidation message in terms of the cache protocol to be issued. And this will at some point arrive here. Well, not specifically in that point, but somewhere during the run of the transaction. And by reading from the mutex at some point, we have marked that memory location as being part of the transaction. So having a cache line with the transaction bit set and someone else trying to invalidate that cache line, well, what will that do? That will destroy our transaction and cause an abort, and the whole thing will try to be it will abort for once. And also what will happen is this abort will kind of revert the program the program counter to the X begin, returning with something else than -1. So in these cases, the code will then go over to the fallback path, and also try to acquire the lock, and then run into being blocked until the other transaction has finished. So that is the way that we have to interpret that. Okay. So there's an illustration of the transaction in terms of you're not quite happy.
No, it's not the code. Could it be that you have your first, if you say you need to check your mutex, what if your process gives control the way down? So after the check of your mutex,
By having that, we have to issue a read message on the cache. If we have it locally, we can just mark it as being part of the transaction from now on. if we do not, then we have to get it from somewhere else. And if we, and somehow we will end up with the cache line being ours. And either we can read off that the mutex is increased already, or that the that it is zero, so everything is fine, and we will mark it with a T. Yes. Yeah, and because transactional memory is not kind of, well, it integrates into the standard execution of our instructions, and the way that it is, it's just transparent. It doesn't do anything more than ordinary execution, but just with this transactional bit there. And as soon as someone tries to write there, you will realize, because of cache protocol and your local cache checking whether your cache line is actually supposed to be part of your transaction.
Does that make transaction memory for multi-tenant applications slightly inefficient? Like, if you have a huge data set and you're doing the same operations constantly, or you have like four processes running through this code, the chances that one will check the mutex and another one will be using it, or one will access it while somebody's trying transaction, is very high.
Well, you will end up with a conflict anyway, even if you would implement it in the standard way. So there's no...
There's a slowdown at that point. Do the eggs begin and everything? If it's never done a whole part, because the conflict is like 100% likely.
Yeah, if that would be the standard... behavior of parallel programs, yes. Yeah, well, that's there are actually statistics on how likely the particular behaviors actually are, and there's a kind of a ranking on the contention of logs, or whether you only use just untaken logs so far, or whether you re-enter logs, or whether you have one writer and a lot of readers and all that. And turns out that the behavior patterns where we have several writers competing for one log is actually the lowest in all the situations. So it's by far not as common as all the other strategies. So if we just have very infrequent situations where two writers collide, then that's still really okay. Well, it's for those cases. What's the optimization for these cases? Okay. So I think it's not so. Not so difficult to imagine how the whole thing works on the cache in these cases. Well, the only thing that we'll get new is that we have this extra bit when we start the transaction set to a cache line as soon as we access it with the read or write. So, yeah, we can have a look at how that works for the setting here. So the start is that CPU A has it's just one data field, so we don't have anything else to think about. So it's exclusive 5, and the other one is just invalid. So in the beginning, what we do is that we read from data. So this will be still exclusively 5 with T for transaction set. It's just flipping the bit. So then we get the read from there. and a read response over there. So it's just doing the same thing as the one above. So it's reading from data. So we now have, instead of exclusive, we have shared, five, and member of transaction. Same as we have here. This is the read response. We also have it shared with five within the transaction. So then, what's happening now? We will have the write to the data here, and in this case we have modeled our cache with the store buffer, so it goes to the store buffer. So data is, well, temp and value, whatever, we don't know. And I think it doesn't also, well, where's no dot for me? Yeah. That's just a question mark. We don't know. And the other one also tries to compute something. So this goes to the store buffer. And this store buffer is not so full, so it's immediately trying to write to our cache line. That's fine so far, but it issues an invalidation message. And yeah, I omit the invalidation buffer here. Anyway, we have the invalidation trying to invalidate that thing. And yeah, at some this is the point now where we have the invalidation message going to the cache line, which is marked with transaction. And I think I'm not quite sure whether the fail is now a direct consequence of the store buffer still being being full with that. So I think that's not the actual cause for the fail. Instead, it's that we have the shared value 5 in a transactional cache line, and we get an invalidate for that. So this is something that will make our transaction over here abort. However, the other one can still get the invalidation acknowledgement and then has modified, I don't know the value, in the transaction here. And yeah, in the end, we can just commit and remove the transaction flag from there, while this one here has to go back to the start. Okay, so I think this one is really not something meaningful here. Okay, so that is how the system should roll. So now that we've seen how we can make something useful out of our transactional memory, we can start to try to extract kind of a general pattern from that. And yeah, so we have a situation here where we want to update a certain index of our data with a new value. And for this situation, before we have had to implement a quite a large-ish fraction of code, but it's a repetitive thing. If we have a different location memory or a different situation in my code where I want to do perform something in a transaction and have something like a fallback code, I will write some parts same as the fraction of code that we have here. And the idea would be now to try to create something like a template from that. What would be the things that that would happen the same for all these spots would be for the first part would be the my attempt to start the transaction and the abortion in case that I see that the lock is already taken, as well as well, this this check also includes the corresponding lock in my read set. Then there's user-specific code happening here, and there's once again the commit in the end with the exend. And the other part that that I also need to incorporate in my template is having the fallback path, which tries to obtain the lock. Then, once again, performs the user code, which is the same as we had before. And in the end, then frees the mutex, releases it. So, if we look at that for a bit, we will see that these are common things that we can extract from that into two different parts, which we encapsulate in functions that we now call lock and unlock, and keep the common parts that we had to replicate over here between them and have a kind of an introduction and a conclusion with lock and unlock. And the what we need to do within lock is now the part that's preceding the user code, which is in this case, we try to initiate a transaction with the xbegin. Then we need to make sure that the mutex is not taken yet. Also, at the same time, have the mutex in our read set of the transaction. And in case that the mutex is not taken so far, we can simply just return. Everything is fine, and we can execute the user code. So what we do here is return. In case that the mutex was taken or the transaction has aborted in some way, what will happen then is we will go back to the place where we started our transaction and now take the other branch, where we just try to get hold of the mutex once again. So that's what's actually happening before either of these two user code parts is in some way executed. Then there's the second part, part for unlock, which is implemented over here. And what does it do? Well, in case that we now have to somehow find out whether we are inside of a mutex or whether we are executing our transaction. And we can do that by checking the mutex variable with that. And in case we hold the mutex, we then have to release it. So that's why we do the signal here. And in every other case, we didn't have the mutex, so what we have to do is we have to commit our transaction. So with that, we have kind of reestablished a similar pattern that we had before when we were just dealing with ordinary mutexes. So we have a lock and an unlock operation, which has to precede or succeed our user data. Yeah. that's properties for at home over there. There's one idea still left, which is the idea of the log elision, because, well, if we have a closer look at what we have as our pattern here is, well, it's always repeating this lock and unlock. That's the same as the mutex we have before, but it just has one special thing that that is specific for only this this transactional memory thing. And what it is that the that we need to take special care on the mutex bit. Okay. The thing is that now with the our test whether we still are within the mutex, we would rely on reading from this mutex variable. If we are if we would want to replace the standard mutex implementation that is out there for or has been out there for quite a lot of time, and if we would like to replace it with our pattern over here, we need to make sure that the that we can in some way keep to the old semantics that we had before. And the old semantics was saying to us that we could check whether we actually are in our transactional area by checking whether we actually somehow own our specific mutex. So this would mean that the that even though we have chosen this path inside the transaction where we have only read from the mutex variable in some way, we would have to make sure that reads from the mutex in within the transaction area now respond by having a value different from one. And in some sense, we would have to simulate that this particular memory area for the mutex would have changed. And in order to cope with that, there's another hardware feature added that should help us in doing so, which is the hardware lock elision, which kind of hides this behavior that we don't actually touch the memories so far from the process itself. So, in order to also, it already kind of gives you special purpose instructions to better try to simulate these lock and unlock idioms that we have in standard mutex implementations. And these are the special X-acquire and X-release prefixes that can be added in machine code in a way that they that on machines that do not support this hardware lock elision, the code is still valid. However, it doesn't do anything related to transactional memory anymore. And in case that you have transactional memory on your processor, this X-acquire and X-release would lead to the semantics or to the underlying machine to behave a little bit differently than before. So the way to use this hardware lock elision is this scenario where we want to migrate old code, which would still link against this lock-unlock structure in some way, to using our new transactional memory features. To do so, we would implement the lock and unlock almost in the traditional way, with still trying to increase our counter for our lock and decrease it at some point, but we would precede the particular instructions for increasing and decreasing with X-acquire and X-release. And this would lead the hardware to do the locking a little bit differently than before. What it would do is it would reuse a little bit of the hardware that we have already introduced for restricted transaction in memory. Specifically, it would use the register bank and the counter as well as the transaction bits in the cache lines. However, there would still have to be one additional component, which is the elided locks. And the idea is that in principle, you could introduce this the lock elision already with restricted transactional memory only. However, this would mean that you, the part where you increase your lock counter would have to be somewhere within the cache. So in these cases, in the cache line, there would have to be already something modified in there. And as these cache lines happen to be a little bit larger, it might be that you have also a little bit more of user data in the same cache line than the counter that you use for your mutex that you try to access in a transactional way. If you do that, you will immediately have a modified transactional cache line, which would together with read messages from outside, lead to immediate cancellation of your transaction, as you have only modified state in your memory, and if someone else tries to read from that area, then this would already abort your transaction. In order to improve on that, what is specialized here is that specifically the values of the locks, there's another buffer introduced. That is the part that I've highlighted over there, which is this elided locks buffer, which is an extension of the ordinary store buffer, and it keeps book of the value of your transaction counter separate from the main memory, so that or the cache, so that the cache line can still act as being only in shared state, so that other processes can still read from that cache line, and only when the others try to access that cache line with a write, they would send an invalidate message there, and only then the whole system would end up with a conflict. So this is a kind of an accelerating means for transactional memory for that very special case where you would try to replace standard locks with transactional memory. However, this is quite tricky to implement in the right way because, there's also code out there which tries to just check with whether a lock is taken without actually trying to wait for when the lock is available. And in these cases, well, you would kind of get the wrong value from the elided lock because the cache line over there, which is actually used to was meant to be used for storing whether the or storing the value for the lock counter, would still have a zero in there. However, your lock is actually taken, so there might be quite tricky situations with this kind of proceeding, and yeah, it's quite dirty to look inside of that. Anyway, I didn't want to go too deep into this whole log elision and transactional memory stuff because it's actually really hard to get real information about that. So that's just to show you what's behind the curtain a little bit with the cache implementation, with the transactional bit and the invalidate and read messages being responsible for aborting your transaction. That's already as deep as I want to go. So let's sum up with transactional memory. So what have we seen? Transactional memory is actually the concept behind the construct that we have used for so many slides now, which is these atomic blocks. And that's an attempt to bring that to run on real hardware. It's actually quite liberating for you as a programmer, as it frees you from thinking about things like deadlocks and about lengths of your atomic sections and all that, or at least up to a certain point. And it also behaves better in the sense that it's opening you. Ways for communicating in a compositional way, because you can just call one transaction from the other. Yeah, there's different ways to implement that. You can have with atomic updates, with logs, or even with hardware support with transactional memory. However, there's a few things to consider when implementing that. So it's quite subtle to get the collaboration between the parts that are hardware supported and the non-hardware supported parts to work together in a safe way. Think about weak versus strong isolation, and also, you need to have these fallback paths in software transactional memory, which software transactional memory was also quite. Hard to get right in the beginning. Then there's also, it turned out to be not so simple to actually define what you mean when you say that you want some kind of consistency in your transactions, especially when you have parts that are not really part of your transactional system. So. Yeah, for that you have to resort to things like these single log atomicity or transactional sequential consistency, which have both of them have their specifics. We've talked about the transactions not being the right tool to synchronize. Okay, I think that's given. Opacity was something for which we have talked a little bit how to get that, and that there are certain properties of your transactional memory that you need to have in order to get this opacity, which would be this eager conflict detection or the lazy version management. And also harder transactional memory, although it seems to be quite a worthy goal to have. You still need something like this fallback path, because in practice you can only have this special restricted hardware transactional memory, as well as there's certain things that you cannot include into hardware transactional memory by default, like these IO related things or the volatile memory and all that. So you always need these fallback paths. Yeah. And there's also ways you've seen how you can implement support for transactional memory by simulating this log structure. So that's kind of implementing a software, the bridge between the common construct of a log and our new features of transactional memory. Then, in practice, how can you profit in some way from transactional memory? Well, at least in GCC world, you can you can have these atomic blocks by just using these transaction atomic keywords in front of a block. This will mark the following region as being meant as a transaction, and it will equip the code in there with these special instructions that you've learned, which is this tx start and this tx commit and the respective writes and reads and all these. And those will go to a certain library, which then will fork on systems that have transactional memory extensions to the respective calls or the respective instructions for transactional memory. And in systems without transactional memory, it will resort to a software implementation of transactional memory. And also, well, for supporting hardware transactional memory, there's also the fallback option that you have to offer, and this is also done with the same software transactional memory parts of that library. So with that, you can already use the features for transactional memory in practice. Also, well, it seems that certain JDK providers like Oracle or the OpenJDK community already have at least plans for introducing restricted transactional memory support in your virtual machines. At some points I've read about extensions like special parameters, XX, use RTM, or something similar for enabling the usage of transactional memory in order to implement your monitor features. However, I couldn't find anything really reliable that the features actually rolled out, so I haven't really tested it in practice yet, perhaps in the years after this one. So we'll see, but it remains exciting here. So, yeah, there's also a few caveats of lock elision as the kind of the hardware acceleration of our common lock structures. And yeah, there are a few downsides of how standard pthread locks are moving to hardware lock elision. But you can read about that in the sources. So I will just give you the links and leave you there. So it's quite dirty down there in the bowels of pthreads. So yeah, where are we standing now? We haven't still haven't covered a lot of other principles of concurrency, like actor model with message passing. We haven't talked about something like p calculus, which also kind of a messing passing style, in this case blocking. And there's also specialized systems for usage in embedded systems, for example the priority ceiling protocol, which are, well, these systems are actually able to give certain kinds of guarantees about the runtime of your system. So it's also quite interesting. However, we have already reached almost the half of our lecture, and we now want to leave the world of concurrency and have a look at other language features, because, well, I think by now you have got most of the extensions in the machine model of the last recent years, and are now kind of up to date to what the machine model actually offers and what new semantic constructs are emerging from these changes in hardware. Yeah, if you're interested in transactions and transactional memory, there's still a few references or sources where you can find material for that. Apart from that, I would now switch over to the next topic if there's no question. Okay. So, let's start.